everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about the books we write and the lives we lead and how these two are one and the same. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the Internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, as well as their fabulous yearly Summer Writers Conference, please go to pnwa.org. Well, today my guest, well, I'd hoped my guest, and I still hope my guest, would be Washington State's Poet Laureate, our very own Poet Laureate, Kathleen Flanagan. But Kathleen appears to be experiencing some technical difficulties. I'm still holding out hope that she will join me soon. But until then, you can, if you'd like, call into the show. Our phone number is 661-449-9357. Again, that's 661-449-9357. You're welcome to call in, talk about writing, talk about the life of the author. The life of the author. The author. I don't care if you're the author of poetry or short stories or novels or memoir. The life of the author remains somewhat universal amongst all the disciplines. I talk about this a lot, but I think it is a subject that goes somewhat unaddressed within the writing community. Our focus is so often on the craft and the business of writing, as if all our answers lay there within the craft, within the business, and how to get published what we craft. But I think that the challenges facing most people who decide to take what they write in private, public, go public with what they write in private, has nothing to do with craft and has nothing to do with the sort of ticky-tacky business of trying to get published. It has to do with surrendering your work to the unknown that is other people. Honestly, that is other people. It might be your writing group. It might be your friends. It might be editors or agents. It might be the reading public. You might publish something on CreateSpace. But you have to surrender this thing to the unknown and allow what is going to happen to it, happen to it. And often the things we write are very personal. They are created in private where they must be. They come directly from us. And out they go. You know, I was thinking about craft because I was talking to a client recently who wanted to learn how to write a story, wanted to learn how to write a story, as we all do, I'm sure. And there's plenty of advice we can give each other about how to write stories, how to craft a story. You know, there are the three acts that show up in almost every story, the setup where we learn our character, our hero, learn what challenges lie before him or her, how they're trying to, what they want and why they can't get it. And then we have the middle act where all seems to be lost. Invariably, the tension rises, the stakes are raised. At some point towards the end of the second act, the hero or heroine will face death in some way, probably the death of a thought, the death of their actual lives, possibly. And usually by the third act, the story will resolve. Maybe if it's a tragedy, the character might die, and we, the reader, will experience a sort of rebirth within ourselves of as their what they could not perceive is perceived in us. That's the tragedy. Or, in most stories, the hero does not die and learns what they must learn to get what they need, what they believe they need, to find their peace, their happiness, their loved one, solve the crime, whatever the challenge is. And this is the traditional arc that most stories follow, and in fact, this is indeed the hero's journey, the traditional hero's journey with the gem in the cave and the older person offering the journey. Oh, I seem to have just gotten an email from my today's guest. Let's see if maybe she can. Oh, well, she's trying to call. What I'm going to do, ladies and gentlemen, is I am going to write back to Kathleen Flanagan. I'm in the middle of a great little chat here, but I'm going to try and call her because I would love to have her on the show, and I think you will like to have her too. Sorry for the technical difficulties. Let's see, 449. You see, I'm alone, as all writers are at some point or another. And and I am alone doing the show. But you know what? I have you. She'll get this email. I'm sure she will join us. Anyway, the point is this about stories. I'll wait until – I will chat on until she comes back. The point about this is about stories is this. All stories do follow this pattern. They do. This sort of rising tension in the climax and so on. But it's not paint by numbers. Every story begins inside of you. It didn't start outside of you. And all that story structure, those three acts and the hero's journey, all of that exists outside of you. And that can't tell you what your story is. It can guide you. It can give a structure. But the story, the actual story, exists inside you. And you cannot simply lay down a story. You can write a story that follows exactly the hero's journey, piece by piece by piece by piece, and yet it still won't work. It still won't be an actual story because a story begins in you. It's an idea that lights up in you. And that is what you follow to find the story you want. Not some pre-constructed architecture. That will probably arise anyway if you tell the story from within you. And so, I encourage you, as you go on your own writing journey, yes, learn about the structure of stories. Yes, learn about the craft of a scene and characters and so on. But understand that every story you're going to tell begins inside of you, and that light that went off in you, that will continue to be the source of the story you tell all the way to its end. It must be. It's where it started. It can't. Ah, look at this. I believe we have a guest. Let's see if we can get her on. Hello, Kathleen.
Hi. Hi, Bill. I'm sorry for the mix-up.
Oh, it's okay, Kathleen. We're just glad to have you on the show. You know, fortunately, I can just talk and talk and talk. It doesn't matter whether anyone's there to listen or not, apparently. But I would much rather talk to you than to myself. So welcome to the show. As I said earlier on, listeners, I've got on the air Kathleen Flanagan, Washington State Poet Laureate. How are you doing, Kathleen?
I'm well, thank you.
You know, you're somewhat unusual for writers, and poets in particular, I think, in that you came to it a little late, didn't you?
Yes.
Now, how late did you come to it?
Well, I didn't really start writing and publishing poems until my early 30s.
Holy.
So I when I was in high school, I was a little interested in poetry. I had a friend who was a poet, and you know, in high school, you can only have one friend who's a poet. You can't both be poets.
That's enough.
So I was the appreciator and admirer of her poetry, and I was a trusted reader for her through those years and after. It wasn't until my 30s when I was casting about for something to occupy my mind while I was home with my small children that I took a night class in poetry, and I kind of just fell immediately in love with it. I guess it was a combination of just being ready for it and being exposed to a new kind of poetry, not so much classical work as more contemporary work that really spoke to me. And it seemed to make room for me in it. So that
made room for you.
Yes, I think so. I was leading a very ordinary life at home with small kids, wheeling a grocery cart around the grocery store.
I know this
and
life very well. Maybe too well. And yet this is often the stuff of your poetry, isn't it? Certainly the first collection.
It was definitely that first about 10 years of my writing life was really trying to find poems in that life, but not just spilling out this is what I did today and calling that a poem, but trying really to find some larger truths in my experience of the world.
Isn't it true,
so,
Kathleen? Don't you find, now I don't want to put words in your mouth, but every moment, every single moment of life has the potential to offer itself as like a keyhole into life in its whole. That it all exists in any moment. I don't care how mundane.
No, I completely agree with you. I think there are all kinds of possibilities. I think Flannery O'Connor said something about you've lived enough by age 12 to write for the rest of your life or something to that effect.
Oh, did she? That's great.
It's something like that, and I do believe if you can make poetry out of just about anything. But I didn't know that when I was a young pre-writer, pre-poet. I thought poetry had to be about important things, I did something good and bad in high school. I wrote a big paper about Robert Frost, and his poems were so. They were so magical, but also kind of like closed boxes. I didn't know how any human being could write a poem like that.
Right.
And I didn't see how I could ever create something like that. So it was later on when I started to see poems written about more ordinary matters that I thought, well, gosh, maybe there is room for me in there somewhere.
Yeah, and that, of course, that came about to some degree. Well, I don't like to get too historical, but I always think of the sort of William Carlos Williams hated the wasteland. He just hated it, apparently.
Yeah,
and
right.
If you took two poets who were more diametrically opposed in their style and content, you could T.S. Eliot, especially with the wasteland, and William Carlos Williams and his rain barrel and all that. You couldn't find two more. And I think but there was a huge wave of poetry that really followed Williams. I think, and that finding it in the ordinary,
and a lot of people. Yes, I agree, and I think a lot of people take exception to that. They think, well, we've lost poetry along the way, and now everyone thinks the pretender that. Imitates the imitator who imitated the original, and that it kind of deadens poetry. But I don't think it has to be that way. I think you can make real poetry out of ordinary things.
Of course, and it reminds me of something that's been on my mind a lot. But boy, I think she was so right. So Chelsea Kane writes suspense novels. She lives in Portland. Very nice woman, the sweetest serial killer writer you will ever meet, and. And she told me something which has stayed with me since she told me it, which is she felt she became a successful writer, which for her meant she could finish a book, when she ceased to be afraid of cliches. What she meant is if an idea presented itself as a cliche, she wasn't afraid of it because she knew by the time it passed through her and came out the other end on the page, it would no longer be a cliche. It was okay to start as something familiar as long as you let it pass through you honestly. It became something original. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, it does. That passing through part is fairly critical.
Yes, it is.
You have to be made of certain stuff for that to be a transformative experience. But, if you've got what you can take, and you can take something that's old and make it kind of fresh, that's great.
When I think back when poetry sort of started lighting up for me, I remember I was 15 and... this fellow who was a local writer had come to visit our writing class in my high school because I knew then I wanted to be a writer. But I wasn't much into poetry, and he quoted the lines from The Tempest, Full Fathom Five. He just said that. He happened to throw that off, and all of us stared back at him blankly. He said, "You don't know what that's from?" And we all said, "No, And he said, "I'm not going to tell you. You have to go find out for yourselves." And so I really loved the sound of it, Full Fathom Five. It just sounded so cool. And I loved music also. And so I went in search of it, and I had it. I was certain, I was absolutely dead certain that it came from a poem that I'd heard about called The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. It just made sense to me. So, of course, it wasn't in there, but I read The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And I will tell you, something happened to me when I read that, because I saw that words could be music. It was the same thing. It was the same thing. Now, not all poetry. I mean, obviously, this is very, very different than what you're talking about. But that was a light-up moment for me, that my love of music was applicable, because I couldn't sing, but it was applicable to the written word, that it could do the same thing. And so I'm wondering if you had a similar experience with a poem or taking that class where something where you can remember where you said, oh, I get this. I get this. I can do this. or this is something I hadn't thought about poetry?
Well, I think I was just ripe for it. I think everything I met in that class fell under that category. That, you know, at home I had two little boys waiting for me to, you know, take care of them, and I had a lot of duties. But this was something that I thought, I can think about this. I can read and consider these poems I'm reading, and then I can try to do some writing, and all this can happen while I'm living my life. And it I had a background in music. I'd been playing piano all through my youth, and I didn't have the time to sit down, or, to be frank, the passion for it anymore. It didn't just speak to me then. And to find this art form suddenly that was just exactly what I needed at that moment was just a revelation, and it wasn't any particular poem, although there were favorite poems from that first introduction, but it was really just the whole part of it that I thought there was room for me, and that was like a door opening.
I love that, there's room for you. There always is room for us when we have to be connected to ourselves to see the room that exists for us.
Mm-hmm.
Understand? In other words, we have to know what it is we desire. Part of you had to be connected to the part of you, or you had to be connected to the part of you that was looking for a place. That's, I think, a critical element in this. You know, when I interviewed Edward Hirsch about 3 weeks ago now, I think, he said something which I just love, which is, no matter how much success you've had, no matter how many you've published, or how much acclaim you've received, nothing will save you from the next poem, was the way he put it, which I just loved. And I think it's appropriate for you, because you're a poet laureate of Washington State, and a lot of poets, people writing poetry, would love nothing more than to have a little attention. A lot of poets go unrecognized or feel deserved.
Yes.
And you have an actual title, and you obviously
Carry a card.
What's that?
I carry a card. I am a card-carrying poet.
Card-carrying laureate.
It says it on a business card, and I don't think there'll ever be any greater evidence of it than that.
Well, so my
Sorry
point
to interrupt.
Is, do you resonate with that, given even, you know, the success you've had relatively quickly in your having started late, that you've been named laureate? Does that idea of nothing saving you from the next poem resonate with you at all?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm constantly worried that I'll be, you know, found a fraud. I mean, I think that's just sort of the normal state of being, and so you are only as good as the poem that, you know, you haven't written yet. And
yes.
And I think that's part of the process, part of the creative spirit is, you know, it's not, you don't rest on whatever the best thing you did last was. It's what you're going to be writing, and it's got to be better, and that can be hard. I mean, I, for a while, about 2 or 3 years ago, I wrote a play because I just needed kind of a palate cleanser. I'd been being so hard on myself as a writer, and I have this bad tendency to revise as I write the first draft,
right,
which is a tendency to kind of kill the spark. I mean, if it's
right.
Like, oh, not that. No, oh, I couldn't say, oh, that's
oh,
wrong,
yeah,
cross,
yeah,
cross,
yeah.
Cross. You know, that kind of, that can be killing for writing new drafts. And so trying out a completely different genre for me was just so freeing, and I had so much fun. I mean, I didn't know what the hell I was doing, and so that, you know, that process reminded me, oh, it can be like this. You know, I can have fun writing, and I tried to take that spirit and return it to poetry, and I think to a good extent I did manage it, but I did have to be reminded in another genre that poetry doesn't have to be just, you know, a struggle all the time.
No, it doesn't. But, you know, I do think it's like this. You have children, obviously. This began when you were home.
Yes.
You came with children. I have two boys. And my wife and I often talk about how you have a kid, and you know, they change so rapidly, and they expand, you could say, I mean, physically and mentally, they expand so rapidly. And just as you've understood where they are, and just as you've understood how to be a father or a mother to that child,
mm-hmm.
it's too late, they've changed again, you know, and now
mm-hmm.
their challenge, the thing that worked yesterday does not work anymore. And I feel like
right.
it's the same way with our work, which is you finish a poem, I finish one of my essays or this book, and that's great, and already within me is the thing that's wanting to move on and is done with
mm-hmm.
that. And it's calling to me, and if I don't follow it, it will be more unpleasant, but it will be different. It will have to be different than what I've done.
Well, I think that's all good, healthy matter, because I mean, I think there are writers who fall into the trap of, well, I've been successful with this, so I'm going to stick with this thing I know how to do, and then they
yeah.
get caught, and then all the lifeblood gets sucked out of their work. So I think the idea of trying something new that's scary is, I think, critical to growing and being interesting as a writer.
And being interested. If you're not interested, I can't imagine how you can be interesting to your readers if you're not interested in it yourself.
Yeah, me neither.
but it's understandable, though. I read writers and I think, oh, dear, they're in a rut, you know, or they're sort of repeating themselves. But I have sympathy for it because the human mind can be so locked into the concept of survival, you know, of just keeping a roof over the head, of the ego surviving and making sure that you're selling books so you can feel like you're somebody and so on, that it's very tempting not to challenge yourself so that you can survive, because
mm-hmm.
to go outside of what you've done might seem like a risk. Does
right.
that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. But you
have
to fight
that. We get scared,
that.
I think.
Yeah.
Of our own death,
well,
essentially.
And I think poets are particularly vulnerable because they
sure.
get, even in the best circumstances, get very little notice and very little attention. And that, you know, makes you feel very vulnerable.
Yeah. Do you have to deal with jealousy from other poets?
Oh, well, you mean from other poets?
From other
or
poets.
Or for other poets?
There's got to be some places lousy with them in Seattle, for God's sakes. Or Washington.
Well, sure. I think jealousy is something that is a, you know, it's a common human emotion, or envy. I have, you know, I don't get it. I don't feel it straight on at all. I don't at all. But I know that there is envy about, you know, why does this come to this person? You know, why not me? I have certainly felt that myself, and I can understand it in other writers too. I think in my job as a poet laureate, I think one thing that I can do and one thing I've taken on is to try to take this opportunity to show off a lot of the wonderful poets in Washington State. And so
right.
it shouldn't all be about me. It should be
yeah.
about
well,
the
you're an
state
ambassador,
of,
really, aren't you?
Yeah,
poets.
More like an ambassador. And you know, I'm kind of a guide. Like, look at all these writers that you may not have heard of. That doesn't mean they're not good. And so
yeah.
I have a blog called The Far Field, which is a title I stole from a Theodore Redke poem.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I try to feature at least three, you know, maybe four or five poets each week on the blog that are Washington State poets, and I try to get a wide range. So I've even had published third graders, student work. I've published, you know, emerging writers, people who haven't published books yet, and I've also published really, you know, well-known people like David Wagoner and Marvin
yep.
Bell, and
yep.
you know, a wide range. And that has been, even though in terms of the time I spend doing it, it's not as large as many of my other duties. It still has felt like something that benefits a lot of poets, and that will be there as a kind of you know, relic of my poet laureate appointment, and it'll remain on the web so people can use it as a resource.
Yes. Yes, I agree. I was just talking to Randy Susan Myers, who's a novelist out of Boston, was on Author to Author last week, and lovely lady, and she has one of the things she has out is a book on marketing before your book comes out and so on, and she and I were talking about the importance of connecting with other writers and of sharing and of being generous with your time. You know, it's very easy for writers to become consumed and like, buy my book, you know, and sell, and market. But sometimes I think some of the best marketing, and obviously what you're doing with your blog is somewhat connected to your post as Poet Laureate, but the generosity to other writers, I feel, is a great way to connect yourself and to really spread what you love. And I can't think of a better way to market your work or work in general than just sharing what you love and helping other people, and not just for altruism. I think it all comes back to us.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I'm also very cognizant of trying to build always an audience for poetry.
Yeah.
And so taking this spirit into the schools as well and trying to share poems with children, share that joy, you know, that I can model for them in writing. And, you know, that's an opportunity for me to bring poets and poems that I love to other folks, and then trying to build a love in this young audience so that they will grow up, and they don't necessarily have to be poets, but it would be lovely to think of growing the audience of readers for poetry.
Yeah.
I also think that the poetry community is so small that we need to take heart in each other. We need to, I take it very seriously. I feel like it's one of my obligations as a poet to buy books of poetry,
right,
to write letters to poets when I have enjoyed the books.
Oh,
I mean, this is something I have taken seriously all along, because I do know how small the audience is. And every time you get a letter like that, or you know, you have a sale of a book, that it matters so much.
It does.
A lot of poetry books, they sell in the hundreds. They don't sell in the thousands. They sell in the hundreds. And so each purchase counts.
It does indeed. And poetry still, for me, remains one of my quickest routes to the soul. That's how I've always thought of it. I love its compactness and its ability to get to the core of something so quickly and so deliciously, hopefully. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's a very different experience than the long journey of the book, which is lovely, too, of course.
Yes, indeed it is.
But there's something so just edible about a poem that can get right to the heart of the matter, whatever it might be.
Well, and it so suits, I mean, when I think about how I entered poetry as a young mother, you know, but the time was always broken up into, you know, small pieces,
right,
that it's just a form that fits that life, you know, that there's certain times in your life when you maybe don't have, you know, you can't spread out and write a big, long novel. Maybe you can only work with a short form like poetry. And so that particularly suited my life as a young mother, and I fell in love with it. But that doesn't mean maybe, you know, I wrote a play, I've worked on short stories, I've written essays, so maybe I'm expanding as my life becomes more free, you know, and my obligations as a mother are less, and now my life as a writer can be more expansive and more...
Kathleen, I hear a little British bird in my ear telling me our show is almost over. I'm so glad you found your way onto it. And then we got a chance to chat.
Me too. Nothing like having the right phone number.
That's right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, and best of luck with the rest of your tenure as the Poet Laureate. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you, Bill. It was a pleasure.
All right. And we're just about out of time, everybody. Thanks for listening. As always, keep expanding, keep growing, keep doing what you love. You really, well, you just can't go wrong, can you? Oh, here comes the music. Time to go. Take care, everyone. Read a poem.